Hello there. Is your mummy at home? Well, is Daddy there?
Yeah, but he's asleep too. He's sleeping on the kitchen floor.
Oh. Could you go wake Mummy for me and tell her to come to the phone? I need to tell her something. Can you do that for me?
This is Girildery, an outback trading centre, part of the vast open plains of the Lower Riverina in southwest New South Wales. The district also grows fine merino wool, produced by those famously tough Australian workers, the shearers, recognised in the nearby town of Hay in the Shearers Hall of Fame. In the 1970s, one of the best-known shearers in the district is 25-year-old Michael Mick Lewis. Mick grew up in the small town of Carathool, about 40 miles from Hay.
It was a good life. We were tough and tough. We done a lot of bird nesting and riding horses. And I was... My brother Mick used to milk the cows, and I used to get the cows and that in. We used to supply the town with milk and stuff. It was a pretty tough life. Mum was pretty tough with us. That's the way we were. We were made work.
Mick's wife Sue is also a local, growing up in the southern town of Deniliquin. Sue is 27, and the couple have two children, Tanya, aged 4, and 2-year-old Mark, who's also known as Little Mick.
The boy, what I remembered of the kids, the boy was a dead spit of Mick and the way he walked and everything. And the girl, Tanya's dead spit of her mother. Just couldn't believe it, how the little fella used to walk and that like Mick.
I don't know of many people that Sue really got to know in Girildery, but I did get to know her only through working at the hotel. And, I thought she was a lovely person, and I loved the little kids, I really did.
In 1978, they rent a small homestead at Summerfield Station, about 12 kilometres outside Girildery, and Mick strikes a good deal on the rent.
It was sublet to Michael Lewis from a lady who lived down the road about a kilometre away, and on the grounds of $15 a week back in 1978, but on the grounds that he would help out different chores around the house, I'd imagine tractor work and that sort of thing.
Oh, nice. It was only an old house, but it was nice and tidy. We were good, you know. And his wife used to look after the garden a bit. I don't think Mick was very interested in gardening, but Mick would do it.
Mick is an accomplished and well-respected shearer and has displayed his talent from an early age.
Ned sheared 200 a day with him in big rough sheep. He was a real good shearer. No one could beat him. No one. A few tried, but they couldn't.
Sure, 200 before he was 16, and that was with the old narrow combs and that. The place where he saw the sheep, put it in the local paper out of Riverina Grazier here. Mickey worked hard, but he drank hard and that too. Nothing for him to drink half a dozen long necks or so before they had tea and that after they finished the day's work. And then they'd have another half a dozen long necks or so later. I don't know how they used to do it.
Mick spends a lot of time inside the Royal Mail Hotel, one of Girildery's 4 pubs, where he not only drinks heavily, but gambles on pool, poker machines and horse racing. As a result, he's generally short of money. Sue has little patience with Mick's antics, and his drinking mates often tease him when she makes one of her frequent calls to the pub to insist that he comes home.
And then there'd be times when she'd be in town and she would keep the children and herself. They would sit in the car outside the hotel, and then they'd come in and ask Mick, you know, when he was going to go home. Oh, I'm just going to have one for the road or something like that. Or I'm coming now.
I had arrested Mick for sheep stealing on the stock route out of Hay and convicted him of stealing some sheep from a drover's mob there.
We just call him a petty theft type background. I think he had a drink drive charge and some traffic matters. But Mick was a larrikin type shearer, well known. He was a gun shearer, they called him the gun. And just a fellow who loved to punt and worked hard and played hard. But nothing serious. He wasn't a criminal that we sort of regarded as such. He was just a larrikin shearer who'd fallen a few times foul of the law.
On one occasion, Mick arrives home drunk to be met by the full brunt of Sue's anger. Mick points a hunting rifle at his terrified wife, who then flees from the house with her baby daughter and spends a miserable night in the family car. The next morning, she agrees to return after a sober Mick vows to get rid of the weapon. On Friday, the 29th of September 1978, the eve of the October long weekend, Sue is visiting her mother and father in Deniliquin. By the time Mick arrives after work, Sue and the children have eaten their dinner. As they drive off, Sue waves and calls out to her parents that she'll see them again on Monday night. It's the last time they'll see the couple alive. For all his spendthrift ways, Mick is still a reliable worker. And so early on the following Tuesday morning, when he fails to arrive for work, his boss checks with Mick's mates.
He had a lot of friends in the shearing game. They consult each other regularly because of wet sheep and that sort of thing, and they can't go to work. Or they share the petrol expenses. I believe there was one of his friends tried to get him the whole weekend and couldn't get him to answer the phone.
The boss calls the homestead himself, and getting no result, he contacts the local exchange. These are the days before automatic telephone exchanges, when, because of the vast distances between homes, a number of isolated properties share the same phone line.
Some of those farming towns, I think even today, have still got party lines, as they used to call them, that go through the switchboard. In this case, Michael Lewis's telephone went through the Deniliquin exchange and went through several properties.
For the next few hours, the exchange supervisor keeps intermittently ringing the special ring signal for Summerfield. Finally, the tiny voice of 4-year-old Tanya Lewis comes on the line. She tells the supervisor her mother won't wake up and is turning black.
That triggered all sorts of alarm bells for the supervisor, who thought something was very seriously wrong and in fact rang the local sergeant at Jewellery. Fortunately, kept the young girl on hold and gleaned as much information as she possibly could at that time to assist. And eventually rang up the police again with the additional information.
Sergeant Paul Payne and Ken Waterhouse, his constable assistant, went out to the farm itself. As the door swung open, there on the floor was Mick Lewis, very dead. And he didn't look like he'd been dead for very long. And they walked through another door into the lounge room, and two grubby kids were huddling up to another looking at him.
Where's Mummy?
In there.
And he yelled out, "Where's Mummy?" Susan was lying in bed, very, very black, almost unrecognisable as a woman. Such was her decomposition at that stage.
The officers immediately note the marked difference in the state of the bodies, indicating an all too common domestic tragedy.
Immediately they assumed that he's killed his wife a couple of days before and then taken his own life with some fast-acting poison or something in the kitchen where he was found. There's no other evidence, there's no weapons, there's no nothing. There's blood under his head in the kitchen, and they thought he might have struck his head on a door catch, a cupboard door catch, that was right above his head where he was found, and that could have caused a little bit of blood there. There was no blood or anything like that seen in the bedroom itself.
Homicide detectives from Sydney arrive at the homestead, joining Ray Adams and local detectives. Immediately, they begin to wonder about the domestic violence theory.
That was a theory at one stage, and then there was a lot of other options available in relation to his death. And that's the difficult part, because the two children were left within the house. There's a lot of evidence that at that early stage that they appeared to be there for some time. There were soiled nappies on the floor. There was excreta on the floor. The fridge was open. There was very little in the fridge for the kids to eat. There were broken biscuits on the floor. There was even a partly open, in a rough way, a tin of dog food that we considered at that time that the kids had been so hungry that they were trying to open the dog tin.
But the big question that the detectives asked later was, a man who'd look after his children for a couple of days, why would he then leave them to starve to death? The home was isolated, away from every other place. It was almost a kilometre to the next house where the landlady lived. The children couldn't go out the back and just walk over the neighbours and say, Mummy won't wake up. They were stuck.
Where's Mummy?
In there.
The fact that the person responsible physically had to walk past the kids and that was probably the most difficult part early in the investigation. Visualise yourself what these kids went through. I mean, there's evidence now that the kids awoke either through the night or in the morning or at some stage the following day and went to both their parents. Firstly, Mick, who was lying dead on the kitchen floor, and later to Sue, who was in bed. There's also evidence that one or both of the children slept with their deceased mother.
So it seemed that little Tanya, or one of the children, had gotten into bed at night just to keep warm, because at night it dropped to almost zero.
The police have difficulty removing the children from the home. They're understandably reluctant to go off with strangers. Two-year-old Mark begins crying for his mother, and he's only calmed when Tanya hands him their pet puppy. They're gently coaxed into a police car and taken into temporary care.
We made inquiries about the parents of the children and made arrangements for them to be taken not too far from the property, because they, at that time, were the only real link, the only living link that we thought we had then between the murders and the murder time and the living children.
The children will later be interviewed by police, but they're too young to offer any useful information.
In terms of time, date and place, or what day it was, or a visit to the house, or any little snippet of information that may have assisted the investigators, really wasn't forthcoming at all. And, of course, once the family was involved, we respected the family's wishes. The kids were then in care of a doctor. So we went as far as we could go, within reason.
A quick examination of Mick's body lying on the kitchen floor shows he has some food in his mouth. The oven is open and contains two plates. On one is an omelette and bacon, and on the other, only bacon. It appears that he was cooking breakfast and making two meals. But this observation will later create more confusion for the puzzled detectives.
The bedroom had no signs of violence in it whatsoever, but the kitchen was full of it. There was upturned fry pans and clocks that had stopped, cords hanging out, and even Mick's watch had moved back on his arm to the halfway mark and had broken open like such. And so he had a violent end. That arm had been thrashing around somewhere, probably in the death throes. But also he had one of his pockets turned inside out. Gave us a motive.
The stopped electric clock is another misleading clue.
That particular clock at that time wasn't set for an AM, PM, and there was some confusion whether or not that it was an AM murder or a PM murder.
There were no rectal thermometers or anything to determine rigor mortis and that sort of thing because they'd been dead for too long. In the woman's case, her decomposition probably stopped everything.
The only other scientific method to fix the time of death is a laboratory examination, which measures the age of newborn insect larvae on the body. While Frost is collecting this gruesome evidence, he's puzzled as to why Sue's body is in such an advanced state of decomposition. It's not yet summer, and it's been only a few days since she was last seen alive, leaving her parents' home. But then he finds a possible explanation.
He realised the bed was warm, and they found a single electric blanket on the highest reading still on. With the blanket on 3, the body in the bed, it's virtually cooking, but it's also keeping the maggot population, the fly population, even more alive than in other areas. The temperature dropped to nearly 0 at night, but this woman's body kept warm.
The fly larvae are sent off to an entomologist at the CSIRO in Sydney.
He conducted a full program of scientific tests to determine the cause of death in relation to maggot growth and development to ascertain a correct time of death. As you probably realise that with Mick having a small amount of decomposition visually and Sue being much more advanced, the time of death for both people was terribly, terribly important.
It'll be some weeks before the tests can be completed and a time of death fixed. In the interim, the detectives begin a detailed inspection of the house. They photograph the death scenes from multiple angles and take fingerprints from all surfaces.
A fingerprint officer was dusting that refrigerator later and he thought he found bloodied finger marks, just the tips of fingers. But when he dropped to a knee and pulled out a magnifying glass, he could see that those little tips were real fingerprints of a child with probably beetroot juice on them.
There were no traces of blood in the bedroom, but a few bloodied hand marks were found on the outside of the bedroom door and in the hallway about 1.5 metres from the floor.
Within a few days, most of the fingerprints were eliminated. There was always a couple, and even to this day, that haven't been identified from that house. But I suspect they belonged to Susan Lewis. And Susan had never been fingerprinted. Her body was too decomposed to get any proper fingerprints in any case.
The evidence so far continues to support the domestic tragedy theory. It was even possible that she'd either died in her sleep or taken an overdose. It's not until the undertakers arrive to remove the bodies that a more sinister picture emerges.
When they threw all the blankets back, a little metal object flew out and rolled across the floor. And the physical evidence officer, Dave Frost, went after it and was rewarded with a .22 cartridge shell. Recently fired, quite clean.
Thank you. Mick and Sue Lewis's bodies are taken to the morgue in the nearby town of Finlay. The couple's parents are told of the tragedy and they're asked to help with the formal identification. Sue's rings are taken from her hands and used to assist in her identification, while Mick's body is viewed by his father.
I went to Finlay with Dad and Mum the day that I had to go and identify Mick. And the days wanted me to go do it. I said, no, I can't do it. Anyway, Dad went in and done it. Then he come out. It took 10, 15 years off Dad's life, I reckon. I can never forget when he come out, he was staggering and that, and I had to grab hold of him to hold him up. And, yeah, it wasn't a very good day.
Soon afterwards, post-mortem x-rays revealed that both Sue and Mick have been shot.
And with the results of the x-rays plus the reconstruction by the ballistics experts and the scientific, they were able to establish that it was a double murder.
Susan Lewis had three actual images of metal where one of the bullets had fragmented. There were only two entry wounds. Michael Lewis had, on the left side of his brain, an outline of a metal object that looked like a tiny map of Australia. It turned out to be a bullet projectile that had moved from the right side under the man's ear, right through the brain and lodged at the back on the left side.
Police are now faced with an entirely different investigation.
With no weapon and two deceased persons with obviously hit with a .22 caliber projectile, all the theories disappeared.
A full team of Homicide Squad detectives, led by Detective Sergeant Don Worsley, arrives from Sydney.
They went through phone numbers, phone books, cupboards, letters, anything that might indicate the person involved. And they pulled off the back page of a phone book, I believe, that had all numbers written in by Susan Lewis and Mick for various sheds, farmers, doctors. Written in on the bottom was added the word, I remember, Mum, probably by Susan Lewis. There was about 20 names on it from memory.
Volunteers from nearby Pakapanyal Army Base use metal detectors to search around the homestead for the murder weapon without success. Plaster casts are taken of some deep tyre tracks in soft dirt at the front of the house, but they fail to match any known cars. The post-mortem report fixes the angle of the shot that killed Mick, and the detectives now try to pinpoint the killer's position in the kitchen. Walking backwards, one of the detectives bumps into the screen door, turns, and notices a small hole. Taking a fingerprint magnifying glass, he's able to see that the hole matches the size of a .22 bullet.
Now, the ballistics officer reenacted with a police officer as a dummy where Mick, the deceased, was standing whilst he's cooking the meal, and drew a line with a cord from the rear of the skull where Mick was shot through the hole, which actually had the wire pushed inwards, which meant to him that the shot was fired from outside the kitchen of the house.
With a piece of string down to the hole in the fly screen, they could get an angle of the chute. And from that, he eventually came to an old wooden tank stand outside, a very high tank stand, where it seemed that the rifle had to be virtually resting against this tank stand to get that angle of shot.
The ballistics officer encircled the spot with a rope and declared that a spent bullet casing should lie within the circle.
This was very important. Called everybody out and said, get down there on your haunches and dig around that grass, because I think there's a shell there somewhere. And after about 20 minutes, they located the shell.
This new find is compared with the shell found in Sue's bed, and it's quickly established that they came from the same weapon. As the children prove to be unsuitable witnesses, all adjoining landholders are interviewed in the hope that they might have seen something over the weekend. Two local girls say they saw Sue driving into town on Saturday morning, and the couple's landlady on the adjoining farm believes she saw Mick on Saturday afternoon. Now, these sightings will later prove inaccurate, but they do seem to fix Saturday night as the time of the murders. The investigation team now has enough evidence to reconstruct the murders. Mick is standing alone in the kitchen, cooking bacon and making omelettes. Sue and the children are asleep in bed. A man walks towards the house in the moonlight. He leans against the tank and takes aim.
He was cooking the last omelette when he was shot, and as the bullet entered his skull, he too flipped over the whole fry pan, which was attached to a double adapter where the clock was attached, and in the falling backwards, his hand has gripped the pan, at the handle of the pan, so it turned over.
The killer walks into the kitchen, where he sees Mick dying on the floor. He moves through the house to the main bedroom, where he finds Sue asleep. He shoots her in the head.
The way the bullet has gone in, it's hit some nerve or something, and her whole body has sat up in bed, frightened the daylights out of him, and he shot her again.
The killer then returns to the kitchen.
We do know that Mick got $200 on that Friday. There was nothing left. No fingerprints found on cupboards, nothing.
The next move for the team investigating the murders at Summerfield Homestead is to find the brand of rifle used by the killer.
So ballistics then worked on the type of weapon, the type of projectile, and another additional inquiry took place in relation to the make and type and the identification of the firearm utilised.
They study the bullet fragments taken from the bodies, looking for the distinctive marks known as lands and grooves.
As it spins going through the barrel, these lands and grooves spin the projectile and keep it on a straight keel. In this case, he determined there were 8 lands and grooves with a left twist. This is very important because all weapons are different.
The ballistics detective then announces that the team needs to be looking for an Australian-made Fieldman rifle, of which only 2,000 were ever produced.
For every farm you went to in those days, everybody had a 22 rifle. But to find a Fieldman would be pretty rare, and so they got very excited about it.
While the investigators can now recreate the sequence of events, the case remains a major mystery. The time of death is still unknown, and the detectives have to find the murder weapon and also search for a motive for such a cold-hearted crime.
When the shell was identified and the make and type and name of the firearm was established, then became an inquiry as to locate and identify that type of firearm through ballistic records and shooter's license at that time, and the names and the owners and the locations of every person owning that particular firearm had to be conducted. And that was a painstaking, foot-slogging inquiry which had to be done.
One clue to the time of death is an entry by the duty operator's log at the local telephone exchange.
They found out that last call was made from the residence at 11:10 p.m. on Saturday night. But they didn't question that for some time. But when all the other evidence said that they weren't seen anywhere on Saturday, they went back to that switch and they found out that the person who wrote that down was actually scheduled to commence the shift at 11 p.m. on the Friday night.
The additional inquiries that we found had to be done in relation to associates and the time, date and place, even though it was a wide time frame at that stage. Who visited the house, the family, the personal life of two families, Mick's family and also Sue's family, the children, the neighbours, Mick's work associates, Sue wasn't working at that stage, his activities. But because we couldn't actually tie it down to a certain time frame, it was a broad-ranging inquiry.
There was a fair bit of finger-pointing going on. People were coming up and giving little snippets of information, and which is what you want in that sort of inquiry. You need everybody to tell you everything, regardless of whether they think it's right or not. We do need, particularly in these country environments, you need to know the local gossip because you need to follow every lead.
Finally, police get the report from the CSIRO examination of the insect larvae, and it reveals Friday night as the time of death.
We'd lost at least 4 days, which was the most important timing. People changed their stories, we found. People forget things, people forgot detail, people came and went and visited the area. It was only really when we found out the time and date that we could be more specific with interviewing and documenting and recording interviews and actually aim at a particular time.
Appeals are broadcast on local radio and television for public assistance, and dozens of calls are received.
There was a lot of red herrings brought up, but they were done unintentionally. People were trying to help because it was foreign to have such a dreadful crime committed in their community, and everybody wanted to help.
I would recollect that there would be hundreds of people that were actually interviewed. People who just would be able to supply a background to Mick and Sue Lewis.
Mick's neighbours produce numerous .22 rifles, but not a single fieldman is seen. The search now widens as residents of all towns in the district are urged to bring in their guns for inspection. At this stage, they're not told that the murder weapon is a fieldman.
Let's try and speed this up. Let's tell them we're looking for a rifle. Don't tell them what sort. And if it's a shearer involved, the missus might turn up with the fieldman under her arm just to clear her husband.
A command centre was established at the old Girildery Courthouse. Each person arriving is questioned about anyone they know who might own a rifle. It's now that a seemingly trivial theme emerges as detectives hear repeated stories about Mick deliberately wrecking his car to collect the insurance payout. They discover that Sue told her parents they were expecting a $5,000 payout, and detectives now wonder whether robbery could be the motive for the murders.
As I remember, there was a bridge on the creek, not far out of Girildery, and Mick, as I remember, caused the car to roll over an embankment and jumped out just before the car left the road, and so caused the wreckage and then claimed the insurance.
Sue's parents tell police that Mick's insurance agent was a man called John Fairley. His name had been one of those on the telephone list at the homestead, and he'd already been interviewed by police and had given them an alibi for the Saturday night.
John Fairley was a painter by occupation, aged about 40. who lived and worked with his wife and five kids in Shepparton, is also a sub-agent as an insurance agent.
We interviewed him at the Shepparton police station. He was not very helpful with the inquiry. He made out that he knew Mick Lewis, but that's all.
Checks with Fairley's insurance broker, Lumley's, in Sydney, show there are no policies issued to Mick Lewis.
He said that he worked for Lumley's originally. Well, that was found to be incorrect. He didn't work for Lumley's. He worked for some other insurance company. You know, those are the sort of lies that he was telling.
But locals continue to confirm that Mick had recently crashed his car and was expecting a payout.
Mick went to, I think it was Berrigan, I remember, to early hours of the day and wanted to send a money order to his address, wherever it was in Shepparton. And he sent a money order, which was whatever the amount may have been. And some days later, he sent another money order there, and we were able to, through the postal records, find out that this money was in fact sent to him by Lewis. So he did in fact get paid, but then we could not find any insurance policies for the insurance companies to say that these particular things had been negotiated.
As Fairley had been seen drinking with Mick at the Royal Mail Hotel, the detectives then interview barmaid Betty O'Dale.
Well, he was a person that came into the hotel, and he had this other person who I believe his name was Rafferty or some name like that. And he used to come and he'd be there before Mick would come into the hotel, and they got to know the ones that came in, but they always seemed to talk with Mick.
She also tells detectives that Mick had confided in her that he'd received a death threat from Fairley.
And he said, I went to see that Fairley because I paid him insurance. And he said, I went down there because no money's come forward, the arrangements that we made and everything. And he said, he told me that I wasn't going to get any insurance because he hadn't paid it. And if I picked up a fuss or anything, carried on about it, he'd kill me.
Fairley lives across the border in the Victorian town of Shepparton, and detectives make immediate arrangements with local police to interview him again. He's asked if he knew about Mick wrecking his car and asked again if he sold him any insurance.
We couldn't understand why he was telling us a few little lies when we used to go and see him, when it was quite obvious we would find out that he was telling lies, you know, if we continued on investigating, such as who he worked for and where he was and who he went to Geraldry with. And he used to go there on a Friday afternoon and meet up with Mick Lewis. And he said he was with a particular person on one day, and he wasn't with him, he was with another person. And it was quite obvious that he was telling lies.
Detectives have found another possible motive for the murder of Shearer, Mick Lewis, and his wife, Sue. There's something mysterious about Mick's car insurance arrangements. The detectives decide to visit a local smash repairs man who confirms that he had towed in Mick's wrecked car. He also tells them an insurance assessor had called to inspect it.
He told the man that the car was a write-off and that he should sell it for scrap, send the cheque to Mick.
The assessor reveals the man had left his business card. The name on the card is John Fairley.
But as the evidence started coming out from the proprietor of that panel beating shop, and what Fairley had said, that he'd never been there, they'd made a mistake, and yet this person that went there left Fairley's card there, they got very suspicious.
On checking rifle licences in Victoria, they find one owned by a friend of Fairley's named Ray Rafferty. Rafferty is interviewed at his duck farm near Shepparton, and he admits to owning a Fieldman rifle. He gives police some spent cartridges, but he can't give them the gun because he says he's lent it to his mate, John Fairley. the cartridges turn out to be a perfect match to those found at the murder scene.
They decided not to really cause a big commotion. Fairley was painting a museum, or a house at the time. That was his second occupation as a painter. And he was painting away when they came straight in, walked up to him and told him they wanted to ask him some more questions and would he accompany them back to the police station. And he agreed to it.
He's taken to Shepparton Police Station in Victoria, where after an initial verbal interview in which he denied any involvement at all, other than knowing Mick Lewis and Sue, and also having been to the house at least once, denied any knowledge of the additional borrowing of the firearm and, of course, the murder.
But one by one, police present him with the facts and tell him how the murder bullets match his gun. Unable to avoid the truth any longer, he breaks down and confesses.
He was ultimately cautioned and in a long recorded record of interview gave his explanations and reasons to the interviewing police.
Police are staggered at Fairley's trivial motive. They discover there was an earlier occasion when Mick had a genuine accident and rang Fairley to arrange a claim and to have the damage repaired.
Fairley stumbled and stuttered and went on that it was just out of date. There was no insurance on the vehicle at all. And unfortunately, you'll have to sue the other driver, Mick, which Mick did. In fact, he won at court and got $100 a month. Trouble is, he only got 1 month's $100. So Mick, when you look at the whole story, you see Mick really hating insurance, that he paid this $300 to have the car insured, $295 to be precise. He had paid this money, and when he has a prang, they won't fix it.
Determined to get justice, Mick took out another policy with Fairley, and again, Fairley kept the premium for himself.
Fairley then knew, I think, at that time that he was in a fair bit of trouble. He hadn't insured the vehicle. The vehicle was insured for about $5,000, and I think early in the piece, probably a little bit of panic started in his mind. Mick Lewis, being a fairly forceful sort of fellow who didn't let up, made regular contact. I think at one stage, almost every day, he rang John Fairley and demanded that the $5,000 in full be paid for the insurance of his car, as he wished to buy another car. Fairley stalled again and met him again, and I think at the end, push came to shove, and Fairley tried unsuccessfully to borrow the money.
Finally, Fairley is cornered and can see only one way to avoid being exposed as a petty thief.
He told the police that he'd drove from his home in Shepparton to Jewellery, spotted Mick Lewis's car outside the Royal Mail Hotel, waited until Mick left, and then drove to Summerfield.
He followed him home, and he said he parked down the road so the car wouldn't be seen, and he walked up, and he knew the property, he knew where to go, knew where the house was and the kitchen and all those things, that he could do that without being found out or detected doing it. You know? And the property was isolated. It wasn't though he had a close neighbour that would have seen him.
Obviously satisfied himself that that was the time and the place to do it, and the opportunity was there then. He had the firearm, he'd purchased the ammunition. Sue obviously was in bed at that time, and Mick was in the kitchen preparing the meal. He set himself up at the tank stand and then fired through the gauze, killing Mick instantly with one shot to the back of the head, walked through the house, past the children, who were asleep in another room in the house, and then shot Sue twice.
Terrible experience for the investigators to hear this man say how he brutally murdered that woman just lying in bed. Fortunately, whether or not he didn't know the children were there or not, but to leave those children and what those children suffered for 3 or 4 days is unbelievable. and I'll never forget it.
Fairley's confession is duly documented, and he's charged at nearby Wangaratta before being extradited back to face court in Girilderie. It's there that he finally shows his true character.
He was like the proverbial rat in the corner, and has exposed his teeth and verbally abused the prosecutor and the court system and the police involved and denied it, and the behaviour pattern was fairly horrific to watch. And I thought at that time, I've always been very aware of how little pressure it was caused to create the murders, and now a similar pressure in the court. And then he verbally abused everybody. And it was then I looked at him and I thought, well, that's what's happened in this case.
The community's anger is now unleashed as the full details of what happened at Summerfield Homestead are aired in public for the first time.
Now, this was about 9 weeks on from the murders. The community outrage was absolutely horrific. Sort of have to live and work in those small towns to realise that they love their own, and the community was very, very outraged at not only the murders of two local people and a hard worker within their own realm, but also the exposure of the kids and what it actually the kids had been forced to do.
John Fairley's time in court is brief. He pleads guilty and he's sentenced to 2 terms of life imprisonment. He's released after serving just 9 years. The case left at least one lingering mystery. Why was Mick cooking 2 meals when Sue and the children had already eaten and were asleep?
Still a mystery. A number of scenarios, one that was someone else coming to the house, and Fairley had been there before with another person in relation to insurance matters. The second meal obviously wasn't for the children and wasn't for Sue, but it still remains a mystery. John Fairley, at interview, couldn't put any light on that. There are still some theories, but once we had the firearm ID and the admissions, we really couldn't put it together. And it was, unfortunately, it will remain one of those unsolved little mysteries that you come across in an investigation like this.
The homestead at Summerfield once sheltered a happy family. But the people in this peaceful part of the Australian outback will always be haunted by what happened here. How a petty thief invaded a happy home and turned it into a house of horrors.
To the police, the homicide was one thing, but for the type of behaviour exhibited and the mental state of a person who could physically do that, even though the children were spared, to leave them in such horrific, gut-wrenching is the only word, circumstances, to leave them alone and unattached and unfed and in this absolute squalor to fend for themselves is unbelievable.